You're listening to season two of Teaching Yoga, a podcast by me, Cora Giroux. I was a full-time yoga teacher for over a decade. And during that time, I started out hustling, teaching 15 to 20 group classes a week. And I think you know what that is like. I quickly realized that if I was going to keep teaching, I needed to learn how to do business. But not just any business, one that was ethical and aligned with my values, but also supported the lifestyle that I craved. Flash forward to 2014, and I had built a six-figure business for myself running yoga teacher training. In 2016, I partnered with a few other yoga teachers and bought a yoga studio. In 2019, we bought another one. Then at the end of that year, I left the studios and my teacher training business behind to create an online business mentoring yoga teachers. If you want the inside scoop on how I made a reliable living from my craft, I share it all in my new weekly video newsletter called The Practice. Because just like yoga, creating a sustainable business requires consistent, inspired action. And after over a decade of being self-employed, I have a few ideas to share. You can sign up right now for free and get a new video filled with actionable strategies for building a sustainable business in your inbox every single week just by signing up at coragiroux.com/newsletter. It's my mission to remind you that you are not alone, and I hope to be a resource for your life and work on the spiritual path, both in your teaching and your business. But for now, I hope you enjoy the show.
And I haven't yet. Yeah. We had to bet. I'm only here. Yeah. You know,
yeah.
If you don't like this music, then don't be listening to it. You know, I'm just a dude that you know, or something similar. If you don't keep it real, can you?
Hello, 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 and welcome back to another episode of the Teaching Yoga Podcast. Before I get into today's episode, I just want to remind you that we are holding our next info session for our 50-hour Business 101 teacher training on August 26th. That info session happens at 7 a.m. Sydney time, but don't worry if you are listening in from another part of the world and you can't make it live, we will send out a recording to everyone who registers. So if you have been contemplating up-leveling your teaching career into a sustainable business and you would like some assistance with that, a roadmap of sorts to help you take your teaching career and actually learn how to treat it like a business rather than a job, then consider coming along to our info session. It'll be live on Zoom with me, and I will take you through the six steps of how you can actually launch your yoga business. And there will be time for questions and answers if you have any questions about our teacher training. So I would love to see you there. If you are interested in registering, it is complimentary, of course. And you can do so just on my homepage. So if you go to coragiroux.com and do the tiniest scroll, you will see a registration form right there on the homepage. Okay, so on today's episode, I talk with Lara Zabilowitz. And Lara and I met way back in 2013, maybe it was 2014, on a Lululemon ambassador retreat. And since that time, I've watched Lara go from strength to strength. First, I noticed that Lara was running a super successful yoga retreats business, and now she is leading her own teacher trainings and is in the process of creating a yoga shala on her property in Byron Bay. Not to mention, she has been highly successful in a number of other creative pursuits, both in ceramics and art. I invited Lara on the podcast today to talk about her experience running retreats, as this is a topic that I get asked about all the time. Now, I know some of you may not be in a position where you can travel at the moment, but if that isn't a possibility for you, you could still bookmark this one, listen to it, and then so when things do open up again, you'll have that information and be ready to go. So I hope this conversation is useful and inspiring for you. Lara and I talk about why starting small and being patient is a great business strategy. This is something that I stand behind wholeheartedly. How to get started running your own retreat business, domestic versus international retreats, what it's like to be a multi-passionate business person, and the importance of inviting non-attachment into your business. So I hope you enjoy this conversation and that you learn something from it. Lara was really generous with sharing her knowledge, and I'll see you on the other side. Hey, Lara, thank you so much for coming onto the show today.
Thank you for having me. Happy to be here.
You and I were just like sort of catching up, being like, wait a minute, is it 3 years? Is it 5 years since we've seen each other? But you and I met quite a long time ago. No one knows when. but a lot has happened in your life and your business in between when you and I met. And so for the folks listening, I was just wondering if you would give like a little snapshot of like, what do you, like if you were to describe it in a couple of sentences or paragraphs, what do you do?
It's actually, it's such a simple question. I always find answering it really challenging, especially when, you know, I see myself as I wear many different hats. And, you know, in my personal life, in my play, in my business, there's a bit of a full spectrum offering. So yes, you know, on a simplistic level, if I only had two words, I would say I'm a yoga teacher. And I teach yoga, but my passion and my past has also been across the arts and across writing and just creativity in many different forms. And my background was in publishing, in media, in magazines. So a segue into teaching yoga and then eventually hosting events, retreats, workshops, you know, for big festivals and teacher trainings. It's kind of a combination of all the different strings, I guess, that I've accumulated over my years of just living and kind of trying to figure it out. But yeah, so my main work at the moment is holding space and in the broad umbrella of yoga, which for me is definitely movement, but it's also very much to do with meditation, to do with the breath, to do with creativity, to do with freedom, expression, play, music, clay. it's quite a big umbrella at the moment.
Yeah, I know the simple questions are often the hardest. And I really appreciate you sharing because, you know, so many people, the teachers that I talk to and work with, have a lot of different things that they're passionate about. And it plays on their mind. Like, do I combine these things? Do I keep them separate? Do I just do one and let the other one sort of be like this thing I do in secret?
Really significant part of my path, actually.
Would you share a little bit about how you've navigated that?
Yeah, it's something that it's been a very alive contemplation for many years. So yes, there's a stream of my offering that's very much yoga. There's also a stream of my offering which became about art and sharing. You know, I make ceramics and paintings and for a while there, I thought that they were very different. I thought that I wanted them to be separate streams and to have different demographics of people that were interested. And, you know, even to the point of using socials, I had two different accounts and after a while, and, you know, struggling to brand them differently and But then when it came down to it, when I was actually in the process of creating content or sharing on these two separate streams, I ended up realizing that actually the content was the same, that the stuff I was wanting to share, that the words, the invitations were really similar. And I felt like I was double handling a lot. And I took a step back from like a bit of a more of a global perspective to think about who I am and what my offering is. And there was a really strong realization of, actually, this is me. This is my offering, that my yoga is not separate from my art. My art is deeply interwoven with the philosophy of yoga that I'm passionate about. And so there was a very conscious decision to merge the two. And with that, there was, you know, these question marks around, oh, am I going to lose a strong following that's purely there for my art, for example, or vice versa? And there was a willingness actually to just trust, to let that go, to not really care about it actually in the end, and to realize that the people or the students or the clients that were really drawn to me were aware of this full spectrum offering. And that was something that took a bit of courage to stand behind actually. Yeah, because I feel like it was kind of wanting to wear the different masks or hats that other people might want, as opposed to actually standing really grounded in the integrity of who I am and my offering.
Mm. Well, yeah, and you're a person. Like you're a person, and you're not a one-dimensional thing, right? Like I'm sure that when you, in your own like actual lived experience, your life, you're not being like, okay, I'm going to put on this hat of artist, and then I'm going to put on this hat of yoga teacher, practitioner, and then I'm going to put on this hat of like, you know, space holder or, you know, business person. Maybe people can, but I don't compartmentalize in that way. I find it really difficult. And to the point where sometimes you don't even notice, like what you were saying with what you were putting out there on social media, you were doing the same thing, or like it came from the same place, but it took a minute to register it. Like, wait a minute, this is actually all just connected. And I feel that way with business sometimes, that I'm like leading a workshop coming up in a little while. It'll probably pass when this episode comes out, about like ethical and sustainable marketing for yoga teachers. But it's like, I wouldn't have even thought to call it that, because it's like, obviously you would do your marketing in a way that aligns with your yoga practice and your teaching if you are a yoga teacher and practitioner, like obviously. But then you're like, wait a minute, no, it's actually something that you can, you know, call out and own. Just like, you're like, no, I am this person who is an artist, is a yoga teacher, and that there, it's one thing. I love that so much.
It's challenging, you know, for those of us that, when we are our brand, it's a very challenging, vulnerable situation. Like, how does one distance yourself from yourself to be able to create whatever it is, even a workshop description or a style name or a brand name? Or it's really close to home. And I think, yeah, we can get lost along the way of really projecting what we think others want from us, as opposed to just really being, I think for me anyway, the more grounded and authentic I feel promoting what I'm passionate about, that's the easiest way to market. If I'm trying to market in a way that's targeting something that's just not, that's not the all of me, it can feel, it's just not as exciting, and it's harder. I mean, we can do it. I can do it, but it just comes from a less, inspired and meaningful place, whereas much, much easier to just share from the joy and the truth of who we are, and to allow that to become, the transmission or the teaching, or if, you know, the marketing, if it comes to that.
What did that look like when you made that decision to be like, wait a minute, I'm just going to be all of who I am in one place? Like, did you stop posting on one social media? Did you, like, I noticed maybe in one of your retreats, I don't know if you did this before, but you've got some art and some like clay and stuff happening. And it's like, was that there before, or how is that process of integrating actually played out?
Definitely on the events, on the retreats, I've always, incorporated everything. Like, for me, the full spectrum offering is very meaningful to me. So yes, there's live music. Yes, there's always an element of art. But yeah, I didn't necessarily market it like that. I think I was, you know, targeting the yoga industry more, and those that came, it was like an amazing surprise that it was this, people describe it as like a mini festival. You know, I really, it's important to me to really spread the reach of what yoga can mean to us, and really, you know, a freedom practice, a liberation practice can be so different for all of us. And so, yes, when that happened, it's funny, like, you know, if I think even specifically, it was like Lara Z Yoga and then Lara Z Ceramics. That was kind of the two different streams. And then, but then I started feeling like, but it's not just ceramics either. Like, I do paintings and murals. And then with the Lara Z Yoga, it's like, but I don't want to just share my yoga there. I also want to share my writing, and I also want to share my, you know, many other contemplations. And then for me personally, and look, all of us, it's such a different, unique journey to figure out, yeah, you know, what we want to stand behind. But for me, it just came down to, it's just me. And so I rebranded it my name.
Yeah, yeah.
Just my name. And it's personal and scary to do it that way. But for me personally, that felt like the best way I could kind of encompass who I am, is just to stand behind my name. And then, yes, over time I have developed two, I guess they are still two streams, but they're woven together. So this concept of body poetry yoga, or just body poetry as the movement meditation, you know, aspect, and then also art of being. And there's cross-pollination. So art of being, yes, it's the visual arts, but it's also the attitude of just being in revelry at this artistic process of living. Like, that can also be yoga, and body poetry can also be art. So I have developed these two names and styles and brands, but really there is crossover between them as well.
Mm. I love this. This is so fun to talk to you. So when people listen to this podcast, it's pretty much a given that they teach yoga. Sometimes we get people who are in teacher training, but they're either in that stage, they're teaching or they're in teacher training. And a lot of them have been teaching for a while, but in the last like 18 months, especially with COVID, they've kind of like had a light bulb moment where it's like, oh shit, I'm a yoga teacher, or I'm planning on being a yoga teacher, but I'm also a business owner. And somebody maybe does this, but my experience, nobody does yoga teacher training to start a business. I have not heard anyone with that intention in all my years of training teachers and talking to teachers. People become a yoga teacher.
And it would be the wrong way around.
Yeah. And who does that? Because like, go to business school or get a job at like a bank and learn finance and then go do something that's, you know, more profitable. It would be what I would say. It's like, if you have that sort of business mindset, it's just not, I've just not seen it happen. And it doesn't, I don't think it would work, as you said, either. But what happens for folks is that it's kind of like a surprise. It's like, you're a yoga teacher, and then surprise, you're also your own boss and you're a business owner. And, you know, in order to kind of make it work, if you want to do it as a full-time thing, if you want to devote your life to it, people then start having to learn business skills. And one of the things that people have told me is that like learning through people's stories is really, really helpful. Instead of just being like, okay, here are the five things you need to do to grow your business. It's like, no, how did you do it? So I don't know if you would mind sharing in like whatever amount of detail you're comfortable with, but like, you know, if you can imagine that you're fresh and you're graduating yoga teacher training, maybe you're still working in publishing, and then where you are now, like, what are the highlights that sort of come up along that journey of being a new yoga teacher to where you're at currently?
Sure. Yeah. My story is pretty unique, maybe. I mean, look, all of us have our own. There's always a good story behind a yoga teacher, I think. And for me, so I did my teacher training when I was very young. My first teacher training, I think I was 20. First time to India, picked up, went on my own. And my story, my teaching journey is, you know, as for all of us, or many of us, it often correlates with some sort of awakening initiation moment in our lives, and definitely it was that way for me. I struggled with a really chronic, well, I had a very bad accident when I was 18, and the afterglow of that was a lot of destabilization of my nervous system, you know, chronic anxiety, chronic insomnia, which I really couldn't make sense of. And the reason why I'm bringing that up is because it definitely has shaped my teaching path as well. And I was working full-time in publishing and loved it, well, enjoyed it. But at the same time, yoga was my refuge as a student. So it was, you know, back then, no one really that I knew was practicing yoga. It was something I did kind of in secret, and not in secret, but just it was just my thing. It was what I did on my own. And when all my friends were off away partying and, you know, in the early 20s, I was finding refuge in yoga retreats and communities where I felt really held and safe and no judgment, and just could allow myself to unravel with what I was journeying through. So that was like that for many years. And I did my teacher training when I was very young, purely because I wanted 5 weeks in India, and you know, it happened to be teacher training. It was kind of that way around. And without any intention to teach consciously, it just wasn't. It wasn't for me personally a agenda. And many of us, you know, have different reasons for doing teacher trainings, and I know that that is a common one. Some people just want to deepen their practice. So then, a few years later, I was very involved in some yoga communities, and I was practicing, you know, religiously. It was really important for me, and. And then just thinking, so this would have been, I'm trying to think about the date. Yeah, around 2011, 2012 maybe, I became, yeah, very close with some of my yoga teacher friends. And I was very involved in, yeah, just the acro yoga community and teaching communities. I was just became friends with the yoga studios, and I was kind of there, part of the furniture. And I don't know, intuitively, I've always had very much a lot of confidence in my body, confidence in my touch and kinesthetic awareness, and had done some short courses in body work, and just felt very comfortable actually quite quickly in a yoga space, even though I wasn't teaching, and I think just the amount of time I'd spent there. So I started assisting very, very early on. I started assisting yoga. Just for actually to get free classes. And I think I would have been in my, you know, early 20s, and just to get free karma classes. And of course, you know, the timeline of our ages contributes greatly. Like back in my early 20s, it wasn't my primary agenda to make money. I was working already full time. So it was a passion. It was a passion project. And, you know, to get free classes, I'd do some assisting and. But then from there, I started feeling very confident in the role of, for those of you that assist as well, it's a powerful opportunity actually to see the yoga space from a different angle, from just being on your mat and getting comfortable with students and yeah, just walking around the space. And from there, you know, I have a very dear friend, very, very close friend, Claudine Lafond, who, you know, you may know of, mm-hmm. one of from Yoga Beyond, and she's been a very close friend for many years. And back around this time, she was just shifting and changing a few classes around. And without me even knowing it, she just gave me some of her classes. She's like, I remember her calling some of the studio owners and being like, I've got a great teacher that's going to step in for me. I'm leaving this class. And so without me even wanting to, actually, I was thrust into teaching yoga. And yeah, for me personally, I again, it wasn't an emphasis for money. It was a joy. It was a privilege. It was something I started doing, you know, mornings, evenings, and lunchtimes actually during my full-time work. And so for those early years, you know, yes, the pay is, you don't even really notice it hit the bank account as a junior teacher. And I was doing, so this is actually Cora, I think where we met was through Lulu, through Lululemon.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So that, in my story, I think the Lulu community was a big part of those early days. I started doing a lot of community events for free and just going along and meeting students and just showing up and just being a committed member of a community where people were hungry for connection, hungry for yoga. And I remember walking away from those experiences just so enriched, so filled up. And so for me, the evolution of my teaching career was very organic. And this is where I know I was quite lucky. And yet I worked bloody hard for it. And yet, you know, I'd put my hand up for everything. I would be there. I would give my services willingly in the early days. There comes a limit where we stop doing things for free, but definitely in the early days, I was really with a willingness and a hunger to share and to be a part of, you know, the magic that I experienced as a student. So this happened, you know, for a couple of years and still in the publishing world. And then whilst I was working full time in magazines, I became a Lulu ambassador. I think it was 2015. So we would have met sometime around then, actually.
Yeah. Mm. I think so.
And then this became a beautiful launching pad. Just to start to hold space on a bigger scale. I had the privilege of teaching some really amazing, you know, huge live events and opening ceremonies and just started to feel really comfortable in a bigger role within the yoga community. And around this time as well, I started teaching for Body Mind Life in Sydney, which is where I still am affiliated with. And there's been so teaching at a studio where students, there is, I guess, people that don't know who you are. And it's an amazing opportunity to show a part of yourself that, I think for me, the more experiential, like curating experiences for me has been always a significant part of my offering. And I remember from those early days of teaching, like spending so long making it an experience from the words or the poetry or the music perspective, of course, the sequence, but really investing a lot of love into an epic experience for my students. And so this was, the kind of early days of teaching. But I became exhausted because I was working full-time in a different industry, teaching pretty much full-time on top of that, and an ambassador for a brand. And anyway, so long story short, I burnt out. I got really unwell with my symptoms, which had been there really the whole time. And this is often the sacred paradox for many of us on this path, that, you know, we have, the wound and the light that are the two sides of the same coin. And that's definitely been a part of my journey too. So I stopped working full-time in magazines, which was something that I knew I would do one day, but found it hard to consciously make that transition. And I needed something like a really big smack across the face to actually do that and to stop. And this would have been around, maybe 2 years later, maybe 2017, where I stopped full-time working magazines. And then just the yoga world was there to catch me in some way. And I was very lucky for this reason, because the segue into full-time teaching, I was already doing it. So from a financial point of view, I was very lucky that I had already like 12 classes a week that I could fall back onto. So this is what was amazing, that all of a sudden though, I had all that extra time, from not working in an office, to be like, wow, I've got extra time. And from then I started being able to satisfy the arts, and which was a passion that I have, So I started making ceramics again and started sharing from a really there was no attachment to that being part of my business. It was just from passion, really. And to my amazement, that became a part of my offering when people just became more interested in, wanting to purchase the ceramics or learn about clay or learn about, painting mandalas. There's many different ways that, I still to this day am amazed. I think for me, the big theme is that I stand behind a passion. I share very vulnerably and openly about my passion. And people respond and people are inspired by that and then come towards me with a way either to collaborate or for guidance or mentoring. And so I really think my brand has evolved really with the needs and wants of what I've heard students and friends and people say. So I really didn't have a clear goal in mind. I really didn't. I just knew that I loved holding space for, as I said, this full spectrum offering of what yoga and meditation can be about. And it's not just about sitting cross-legged. It's not just about yoga asana. It's really this multifaceted experiential immersion into the beauty of living and being a human. And so that's also been parallel to my healing path and weaving in modalities that I'm processing and digesting on my journey. So it has molded itself into, so yes, the retreats then became a way for me to funnel this love. And obviously a 1-hour yoga class, not possible to start to talk about all these things. And so I had a dream, and this was, would have been around, what would that have been? Probably 2017. I had this dream of wanting to start to run longer experiences for people to connect with all the things that, I knew were just liberating and allowing us to connect to the deeper aspects of who we are. And that was some of the contemplations and questions that I'd been exploring. So the retreat context felt like the best way to do that. And, it's terrifying at first. I don't know if you want me to launch into talking about running retreats.
Yeah, please do.
So that was, it was a vision and a dream. And what I realized that I'm personally good at, I'm really good at the big picture stuff. I really enjoy the big picture daydreaming of planning this event from, the individual sessions, but also the moments in between. My background was food publishing. So color, texture, flavor, so significant. Music, so significant. And this has all been informed by my history and my family, where there is a lot of culture and a lot of color. So there was this idea and dream to bring all of these threads together. And so I did initially reach out to someone that I knew in the community to work with me. And this was significant in the early days, to have someone to help back decisions. I know for me that, and for her in those early days, it was really like when you have no real idea what you're doing or whether you're capable of doing it, but just there's a deep desire and will to have someone to help, like, be like, we got this, like, let's do this. Or especially with the first deposit, it's like, okay, let's share the deposit. And I really take my hat off. I bow to the teachers that straight away out the gates can have the courage to take on really big projects on their own. I do that now, but it's been many years of collaborating with others till I have gained the confidence, the ability, the skill that I now feel pretty grounded in. But those early days, I worked with a business partner and we had very different skills. So me, the global vision, the big picture stuff, I loved it. I loved curating, finding venues, finding caterers, and some people hate that side of the business. And Brooke, who I worked with, she didn't really enjoy that. That wasn't her forte. She had other things to bring to it. So the first few years was in collaboration, and that was wonderful. And especially as we started to go further afield and especially internationally, when you feel like you're taking some big risks and like, who's going to book a retreat in the French Alps, and so to have an ally and a friend essentially, or a business partner to stand there next to you to make those decisions, for me was helpful. That transitioned and over the most recent couple of years, we have stopped working together, and I have really defined my own brand, my own offering, and now really feel like the next evolution of that is, so running retreats that are purely me and my soul and with my partner Benny, and And then the teacher trainings that are really, yeah, all the aspects of the practice that are unique to me. And that feels, it's amazing. It's really amazing. It's taken a long time. It definitely wasn't something I don't think it's even something I thought about. It's just been a one step by step, moment to moment, one event at a time, one year at a time, you know, where do I feel I'm evolving into? Where do I start to feel more confident? And it's been a really natural birthing that for me personally wasn't this like 10-year plan, I want to be running teacher training. It had to happen at a pace that I wasn't even quite sure what the pace would be. Yeah.
That's so good to hear, especially because most of my life has gone that way too. Where, and even if, you know, even if you do have a 10-year plan, like people are different and some people, you know, maybe that works for them. But usually what happens is your 10-year plan changes anyway. So like you, maybe it feels like for that person, they need to ground it in a plan, but it's also that willingness to be open and flexible to what is presenting itself in the moment. And as you were talking, I was like writing down notes of like, what are the themes here? And like, one is like non-attachment, which I think is like the most important thing in business, because, you know, you could plan a retreat to the French Alps and then maybe no one comes. And that's just one thing that happened, you know, it's just let that go if it's not meant to be. But also like patience, as you said, like it takes time and there's, you know, it's one step at a time and not getting too overwhelmed by, you know, what is this going to be in 10 years? But like, what does it need to be this week, next month, this year? And being patient with things as they sort of unfold and meeting the needs of the, or like the maybe not needs, but like meeting the responses of the people that you're working with. Like, okay, well, people are now coming on domestic retreats. Maybe they'd be interested in something bigger, and like letting that evolve in that sort of collaborative way. It's really cool how you've expressed that. Thank you.
Totally. And pleasure. And I think for me, and I, you know, the way I felt, but definitely for everyone, I mean, with the retreat topic, it's challenging because now when I first started running retreats, not many people were running retreats. I mean, not many people that I knew. So all of a sudden, everybody's running retreats, which is amazing. But I think the point that I want to make is not to compare yourself with anyone. What I mean by that is not to bite off more than feels chewable in the moment. It's not, you know, especially, it's like it's building a startup. Like from the early days, you have to be willing to lose money. You have to be willing or to break even. Or to, you know, to not think that you have to have a 20 people at your first retreat. Like, let it be, I think, to feel safe and grounded in the offering helps so much, especially in the future of building the brand or the business or the retreat, whatever, you know, offering. You have to explore yourself, especially if it's the first one or two. It's like, you're not even really sure how it's going to land. So using that as like an amazing experimental testing ground and to be aware that that's actually critical. That's such a beautiful phase of evolving the business, is actually just figuring it out as you go along and, you know, not expecting for it to be making you, you know, tens of thousands in the early days. It's just, you know, for you more than anything, to be like, okay, do I love doing this? Or what works, what doesn't work? And five people come, like, amazing. And then get feedback. Get feedback from everyone. And then, okay, slowly but slowly, as the offering feels more true and refined, it become, for me, a huge part of my offering became word of mouth. And you know, anyway, we can get into talking about that later, but yeah, so just not feeling like you have to compare yourself with anyone else's offering. I think that's really important, and to trust that you are your, same what we were talking about at the beginning, you are your unique brand or identity, or your passions and your teachings are unique to you, and to trust that your students will come, or those that want to be there for you, and even if it's three people, five people, I mean, yes, you know, to make the retreat viable is obviously the goal, but eventually. Yeah. Mm.
I think my first retreat, I did it with someone else and I had 12 people and we were stoked. And I think we made like $400 each for the weekend. And it was a weekend retreat, maybe like, I can't remember exactly. Was it Thursday to Sunday or something like that? So it was like $100 a day that we made, but it was the experience of doing it and learning. And to be fully transparent, I learned that I didn't love retreats as a space holder. And it was just, it was super valuable for me to do that and learn it. And I, you know, I'm such a massive introvert. And I realized that I love the a teacher training environment a lot more, where it's like we hang out all day. And then I go home to my own little quiet space and recharge for the next day. But everyone is so different. And I think the key of what you're saying is like, start small and don't have expectations. Just like let it unfold as it's going to unfold. And also, you know, I would just love to add, which I think is something you do anyway, but just to highlight it for people listening, it's like, you're a yoga teacher because you love that. So enjoy your business, like enjoy it. And if you are running a retreat for the very first time, there's going to be challenges and things that will probably go wrong. But there will be also moments where you can just like enjoy the fact that you're doing this.
And that is the key. And you know, this is where I don't want this to come from like an entitled or what, you know, privileged place, but definitely for the early days, it was not about the money. Like it really wasn't. And yes, the intention was to eventually build something that was profitable, but for the early days, and yes, I was younger. Maybe, you know, I didn't need, depends where we're at in our life cycle, you know, for sure that some people there's a real need for that to be a priority, definitely. But, you know, in my late 20s, I think it was about the experience. It was about the transformative power of these containers. And especially when I was running it with a friend or a business partner, it was just a joy to be able to travel and connect. And we were terrible with our accounting. Like to this day, we still don't even know how much money we made at all on those first retreats. But it just got the offering really in my bones, really in my bones. And now, yeah, it's a different story. Of course, I've got budget documents and things, but the early days, it really wasn't like that. And I don't encourage that. But if you're interested in my story, that's a part of it. It was for the love. And again, this is where I feel my story is a little unique because I was working full time in a different industry, and my teaching, I couldn't even call it work. It was a hobby. It was a joy. And, you know, teaching even at a studio didn't feel like a chore. It was a privilege. And yeah, I think that has really been a huge, I think it's been an important stepping stone for me as well, because this just like, yes, energy of like, yes, I want to be there. Yes, I want to share is felt. And it's a balance. Of course, we want to value our offering. I mean, now very much, you know, I know what I'm worth essentially. And yet there are still some events that I'm like so willing to just give my heart and show up. Because I'm passionate about and think it's like what the world needs now more than anything else. And I really do believe that. So it's a balance definitely between the love and the money, the love and the business. It's a hard one.
Mm-hmm. Well, and like it's just also like it's really great that you were in a place where it was didn't need to be about the money. But I also encourage people that if you think about your teaching like a business, and if it's retreats or if it's your classes at a studio, if it's workshops, if it's whatever it is that you're doing, businesses don't make money in their first couple of years anyway. So you might as well just get on with the fact that for the first couple of retreats or, you know, workshops or whatever it is that you're doing, or if you're opening a studio, like you need to have another source of income so that your expectations are realistic and you can enjoy what you're doing and give it time. It's like a little baby, right? Like you don't expect a baby to be able to like walk and run and, you know, play sports and read a book from day one. That business or offering or whatever, it needs nurturing. Like, it's a lot of give in the beginning. It's like give in the beginning, and and if you can be in a place where you can be happy doing that and expect that instead of having an expectation that it will make a lot of money straight off the bat. And it's not that you're not like, it's not that you weren't good at doing retreats. It was just like, it's the first couple of retreats. They just, you're figuring things out. You don't know what you're budgeting. So you might pay way more for things, or maybe the price was too low and you're like, wow, we basically just did this for free, but that's cool. You know, we're figuring it out.
From a promotional side of it. Yeah. And for me, from a commercial side, I wanted the cost to be low. I wanted people just to come. I wanted people to come to experience it. And then for the word to spread, and then, okay, incrementally for costs and prices to go up once I feel more validated.
Totally.
And, you know, it's a slow process. And I think that, you know, in this industry, we're lucky in some way because the studio teaching is there, you know, as the day-to-day support for finances. Obviously, we know, you know, just teaching yoga, it's not that easy to make good money just teaching studio classes, or, you know, you have to teach 1,000 in a week, which is not healthy for anyone.
Yeah.
But for me, it's been a beautiful balance to have that to, you know, and they feed into each other, of course. I mean, often they're the people that will come on your retreat, but it's also, yeah, in those early days of having the studio teaching or some other form of income for sure, to support the ability to start running these smaller events or workshops is, you know, also a really amazing way to start refining the offering and definitely making more money than you would in a yoga class.
Yeah, I'm calling this a blended business model, where it's like you work in the studio and that's one element of your business. If that's what you want, like, not everybody has to follow this path, but it's like what I guess it's just describing what I've seen. It's like, yeah, it's a blended business model. You work in a studio or in a gym or, you know, wherever, and you make a consistent income, and that income is probably not enough to live on at all. But then you grow something of your own, like a retreat business or workshops or trainings or whatever. I think there could be a lot of creativity around what that looks like. And that the two feed each other, like you just said, and it's not like you need to do just one or the other. And I think that it's like, if you, if you have like a partner who's a really great partner, or a best friend who's a really good best friend, it can be tempting to like make them your everything. And it's like, they're my best friend, and they're my, my gym buddy, and they're my yoga buddy, and we do everything together. And then you're like, well, that's a lot of pressure for one person. It's the same thing with like putting all of your eggs into the studio basket. It's a lot of pressure. It's like a lot that studios like can't necessarily fulfill, like making every yoga teacher, or allowing every yoga teacher to have a really good living wage. So, but there's still so much benefit, as you've described, to working in a studio: community, connection, growth, learning, education, opportunity, students, you know?
Yeah,
I love it. I love it. Could we get into a little bit of the nitty gritty questions that I have no idea about the answers to, because some of these things I've never done, and they're questions that people ask me all the time, and I'm like, you're shit out of luck because I have no idea. But I know that it's COVID, travel is not really happening, so retreats are less of a thing at this particular moment in time, especially if people listening around the world, like we can travel within Australia, but you know, certain parts of North America, people aren't even traveling interstate or anything like that. But I still know this is not deterring people, yoga teachers, from wanting to create a business from running retreats. When you think about domestic, like running a retreat that's kind of local to where you are, like a couple hours of a drive, you know, like a weekend retreat or something like that. When you think about that, versus like your retreat in the French Alps. How does one make the jump from doing a retreat 2 hours drive away from your house on the weekend to holding an international retreat where there are flights and, you know, accommodation, and like, are you going there before the retreat? Like, what's the big difference in doing something in that scale?
Big difference.
Yeah.
Very big difference.
Yeah.
Very, very big difference. And yeah, look, the local retreats are easier for many, many, you know, reasons, some of them very obviously in regards to students finding their way there, getting there, but also actually access to students. You know, usually your students, if you're teaching locally or, you know, especially with a strong community from your studio, they are most likely your target market. And so for me, definitely the early days of running retreats was drawing upon my local community. And, you know, I had a strong community in Sydney, and so that they were my peeps. They were the ones that came away. And, yeah, from a logistic perspective, definitely, look, I highly encourage, whenever possible, make sure you see the venue first. Make sure you've met the caterer. Like, it seems simple, but it's really, oh, for me anyway, I have high standards and of myself, I mean, and therefore I can put, this is what I'm working on, you know, unnecessary pressure on myself to make sure all those aspects are amazing. And yes, so doing the recces and seeing it and make sure, you know, if you do care about that sort of stuff, if the food is important to you, if the sleep spaces, if, you know, I don't know, the yoga shala and the decorations, if that means something to you, which it does very much for me, having access to the venue ahead of time. Look, I've done a few retreats where I haven't been there first, and it just adds so much extra pressure. So locally, obviously much easier. And for the first few years, that's all that I did. That's all we did was we had, you know, Byron. So obviously I was in Sydney at the time, south of Sydney and then further north of Sydney. And yeah, keeping it close to where I knew my community was. So I have a very lucky opportunity as well that, and this is where, look, but for many of us, being a hungry student means you're going to be an amazing teacher, in the way that being a hungry student meant that I traveled incessantly to trainings and retreats everywhere around the world. And I show up. I'm a hungry student, and I love connecting with people. Not that everyone has to be that way, but it meant that I was able to connect with amazing other teachers and studio owners around the world. And my main mentor, who I had a lot of amazing privilege of assisting and touring with for years, she's a very influential teacher. Her name is Shiva Ray. So I assisted her around the world for several years. So, you know, from Greece to India to America to New Zealand and Australia, I traveled with her, you know, I think it was 3 years in a row, like I was following her around. But in that role of assistant, it was an amazing opportunity to start to meet people. And it's incredible to notice that even though I wasn't the main facilitator, my presence and the connection with other teachers, clearly an impact or an imprint was made. And from there, I was invited to start to tour myself internationally. And that became an amazing transition for me. So I have to say, I'm not sure if I would start running international retreats as far away, such as in the French Alps from Australia, if I didn't have community there. Right, you know, Bali, for example, different story. Australians love to travel to Bali. So that was the first retreat I did. It was, you know, Bali, a little bit further away from home, or, you know, but the other side of the world retreat started when I knew I had already been touring for a couple of years and had a strong community in Paris and Switzerland and Spain. And so the leap of faith to run a retreat in France, for example, or, you know, in Hawaii, in America, was relying a lot that people from that part of the world would come. And it happened, but it was a punt, you know. It was amazing when it did happen, but there was a lot of like, holy moly, let's see if it might be a tiny group. And yeah, the groups were a little bit smaller, but longer and so much more immersive. Cool. and so powerful. And those that did travel from Australia, you know, it's an amazing journey to be able to chaperone someone to the other side of the world, someone that they'd never been. I had visited those venues before. I had a strong connection with the location,
cool,
with the venue owner, with the caterer, so that it felt like a safe team to be able to then, you know, yeah, logistically, you are responsible for people traveling, yeah, you know, on a long flight, landing in a strange country where they don't have the same language. And so there's a lot of logistical organizing that, you know, adds a huge amount of extra work, you know, helping people with flights and transfers and insurance and all that sort of stuff. So it definitely was extra work, but amazing. And for me personally, I tied it in always with travel and touring that I had in those parts of the world. So I'm not sure if I would fly all the way somewhere just to run a retreat, because it's a huge outlay, you know, to pay for your own flights and your own accommodation and all that to run a retreat. Often it'll negate your profits. So I like to be able to tie it in with something else if I can, or at least a holiday. So yeah, it was a big step to start running international retreats like that. But and then yeah, I have a few venues that I return to, as opposed to constantly scouring for more, which, look, who knows what's going to happen with this strange world that we live in at the moment. But what I do know for sure, and those of you that are listening that are in countries or areas of the world where you can't yet gather for retreats, be patient, because when it is possible, everyone is starving for it. Starving. Like, I mean that so seriously. You know, we're so lucky in Australia, you know, I was able to start running my first retreat again last October, so 2020 October. And that was, you know, a little bit nerve-wracking, the first one after the COVID crisis. But it booked out in like a week. And then, yes, navigating, of course, the uncertainty of COVID and plans potentially changing, that's a whole other story. But in regards to the desire for people to want to connect, to want to be in a sacred container of healing and being heard and seen after all that we've lived through, it will be a booming industry again. I just know it. However long that will take for us, or how far we'll be able to travel with that, is another question. But wherever we are in our local communities, yeah, it's more necessary than ever before, I think.
Mm-hmm. That's such a good point. And like, if there is a teacher out there listening who, you know, this is what they want to do, and they know that retreats is something that they want to explore, it could be a great opportunity while, like, bigger trips, like international or even interstate, depending on where you are, when those options are sort of off the table, it's like, okay, cool, I can take the pressure off myself. That's just not even possible. I can't do that right now. So why not start small, start doing day retreats or little local things, and building a community, and like starting to test the waters in a really like a measured way with what you can do, so that when things open up again, you're ready. And this is, I was trying to figure out like the word of, or like the phrase for what I've been hearing you say throughout the entire interview. It's like, you were ready for the opportunities. Like you've said, I'm lucky, but you were ready for the opportunity. Like, even when it comes down to teaching your classes that Claudine gave you in the early days, you were ready and primed to take them. That's why she gave them to you, right? You were already in the room. You were already showing up. She knew you were reliable. You knew the students, you knew the community. It was like, you were ready, but it wasn't necessarily an agenda, as you said. And then, you know, you were touring with Shiva Ray, and you were doing that because that's what you felt aligned to do in that time. And then when, you know, opportunities came up to teach internationally or to run retreats, you were ready for it. I don't know what I'm trying to say, but like, you were doing the work to be ready for the, if you want to call it the luck or whatever.
Yeah, no, I think it's an important point, because a lot of us, where, you know, I check myself, and I often say, you know, that word luck, as if it came from
out of nowhere.
Yeah. And no, I mean, some perspective, or, you know, to have feedback from my partner or whatever, it's like, I work really hard, but it doesn't feel like work. I mean, I mean that genuinely. I love what I do. And but because of it, I am doing it all the time. It's exhausting from the excitement. I mean, I genuinely mean that. And to find breaks and pauses is critical, and taking time off from that. But when it is your own baby, or you're planning a retreat, it's like all the things that you care about and love most in the world. Like, oh my God, like it is like birthing a baby. It's the ultimate joy and passion project. So yes, luck, but I showed up 110% and have done, you know, to this day. I love people. I love connecting. I love the context of being in a sacred space, and I will be there, try and be there as much as I can as a student first, and then from there, yeah, to hold space for that. So yes, it's not luck in the way that it just fell from the sky, but I was ready and I was willing and I was open and my arms were open for whatever was next. And then, yeah, I have a very creative mind. Too much in the way that, you know, the off switch needs to come every now and again, because, you know, it's also part of my struggle, like burnout, exhaustion, nervous system issues, which have been there a long time. And yes, to balance that with my highly creative, and I will use the word ambitious, but not in a, you know, it's a funny one, because it's never felt like a hustle that is, yeah, it's not, it's never been to do with money, I guess. I mean, it is to do with building my business and brand, but it's from this like excitable, I want to share more, or I've got some another project that I want to launch. And yeah, so, but noticing when that feels out of balance with my own self-care, and that's my ongoing work. But yes, being hungry and the desire, the passion to share is a very helpful thing to have if you want the business to succeed.
I think I remembered the quote that I was grasping for, which is, the universe helps those that help themselves.
Love it.
Right? Yeah. So it's like you're doing the stuff, and then it's like, oh, you're ready for that opportunity. Here we are. You're in the right place at the right time. But yeah, if you were sitting on your butt at home just dreaming about retreats, you might not have been ready when someone's like, do you want to do a retreat?
No, I think that's critical, because the stepping stones are important. To just be from 0 to 100, if you're not teaching studio classes, for example, you don't really have a community to want to run a retreat that's viable. It's a long shot. Like, to go gradually and doesn't have to be studio classes. There are many other ways of building community, even in a corporate setting. You know, there's many people that want retreats and getaways that, you know, you can call it whatever you want. But to find your tribe, to find your people, and that yeah, is important. And then the need is there, you feel, as opposed to being this huge jump to be like, okay, I've got no community. Now how do I find people? Who do I even market? That would be a big, I mean, I'm sure some people do it, and that's amazing. But yeah, for me, it's been a little bit more slow.
People do it. Like, there is a thing as going viral that just happens to some people, but it has not been my experience either. My experience has been very much like yours, like one student at a time, one connection at a time, one project, you know, and you just, it gradually builds on that. And I think that if someone takes that approach and has that mentality, and they're like, okay, Laura and Cora are both saying it just takes time, it's patience, it's, you know, baby steps, blah, blah, blah. And they accept that. And then if they are happen to be one of those people that it just like, boom, something happens for them, then that's a pleasant surprise rather than banking on that, because I just haven't seen that be the case. I just want to be aware of the time. And there's one question that I would just love to sneak in before we wrap up. And that is, like, if you were talking to your younger self, or perhaps a teacher who hasn't run a retreat yet, but they know they want to, and you could just give them one single piece of advice, what would you say?
Oh, what would I say? I would say, if you wanted to run a retreat, yeah, I think the community is important. I actually do. I think having people that, you know, want to come away with you is important and doesn't have to be many people, but just feeling that want and responding to that want in a way that you can then feel into how to best serve that community with what you're passionate about or what ignites you. So I would say putting the feelers out, even if it's friends and family, for God's sake, you know.
Yeah, totally.
For a little getaway, you know, or it starts small. It can be a weekend retreat, as you said, a one-day long workshop. And then, yeah, I think it would be about feeling, you know, it's a lot to hold space for. It's a lot of hours of facilitating. And as you said, it can go from the morning through to the night. So feeling ready to offer from that place, I don't want to say that you have to be, you know, have been teaching for 10 years, but there needs to be a willingness to, it's very different from teaching a one-hour yoga class, very different. There's continuity of care. There's continuity of theme. There's a lot of sculpting, especially if it's a 2 or 3 or week-long retreat, that for me personally is the magic of what a retreat can offer, that it's not just separate classes. You know, you can do it that way where it's more of a yoga holiday, but that's not necessarily a retreat where there's real added value with longer time to meditate, to contemplate, to share. And so feeling grounded in the offering, I think, is important. And all of us will be passionate about something different. And, to spend the time really getting excited about how you could stretch that out for a longer immersion. And then to put the word out to people and to get their feedback and what people want and would be the first step. And then starting and then going for it and then getting feedback.
Totally. I'm going to ask Sneaky one more little thing. When you are teaching in studios and you're running your retreats independently, any words of advice on like how to not be a dickhead and like to market to your studio students in a way that's respectful of the studio, but also allows you to market to them? Any tips on how to do that?
Challenging one. I do not, well, I mean, I'm not allowed to publicly announce my retreats in class. But what I will often say is feel free to come and chat with me if you've got any questions. I have lots of events happening, you know, not to be specific, like come away with me on the 20th of May. I've got lots of things going on and lots of events and you can say I've got retreats and you can say something like that, but just not to be like, I've got a retreat on the goddess or, you know, just to be a little more like open. So to plant the seed of inquiry or, you know, often for me, the way it's happened is that, you know, this the power of social media through people will often, if they're inspired by you, if they're touched by you in a yoga class, they will often find their way into your feed. And so that's been the most organic ways that my students have ended up, you know, following what I do and using social media. But also speaking to people after class. People come up and have a question for you, you know. That's not publicly announcing your retreat. That's being able to say, hey, like, yeah, I've got this one-on-one or a mentoring or a workshop or, you know, a retreat that's coming up which, you know, might be perfect for you. And so it's subtle and definitely, yeah. I totally understand, you know, studios have their own things going on. So to not sabotage that, but to also utilize students that are there for you, students that come to these classes for you and your offering, yeah, to find a way to sneak into the conversation more of what you've got going on. Because a lot of the time people just don't know. So it's a balance.
That's super helpful. Yeah. Because I know people are like, how do I do that? So thank you for sharing a way that kind of balances, you know, being respectful with also letting people know what you have going on if they're interested. One final question. I've said that three times, but could you finish this sentence? If you really knew me, you would know.
If you really knew me, you would know that I work too hard. But I do, you know, I think I touched on it before, that it doesn't feel like work, but I need to balance my nervous system. We all do. As yoga teachers, my God, like we need to practice what we preach. We need to heed our own advice like the most, especially when we've got multiple pots on the boil and projects, or if we're teaching a zillion classes a week. And for me, I don't want my health to suffer because of holding space for others, which is the craziest irony. And it's happened to me a lot. And so, you know, if you knew something to know about me, that, yeah, when you've got high standards of yourself, and I know it's both a blessing and a curse. It means I'm able to hold space for others really powerfully and on a big scale, but sometimes I suffer at the same time. And yes, to level the scales on that is a lifelong journey.
Yeah, I think a lot of people listening, included myself, can relate to that. Lara, where can people find you? What's the best place for them to connect? Website, social media, email list? Where should they check you out?
Yeah. All the things. So website is just my name.com. So LaraZilibovitz.com. It's a long name. I'm sure you'll have it somewhere.
Yeah, I'll have a link.
And that's the same with my Instagram and Facebook, is at my name, at Lara Zilibovitz on Instagram and Facebook. And yeah, so on my website, I've got lots of my offerings. And of course, the world that we're in now, I'm sure you've done so many interviews around it, but the online world, I do have a lot and made that transition as well, and I'm endlessly blown away about how transformative it can be for some students that don't have access to in-person. It's been a really powerful lifeline through these couple of years for myself and for my students that are abroad. So online stuff, workshops, retreats, trainings. If you're in Australia, I've got lots of fun things happening, and retreats at the end of the year. So,
or maybe even that. If you're not in Australia and we can travel, you can plan a holiday and come to Australia. It would be so nice. I'm sure there are lots of people listening who, you know, when it's possible, would jump on a plane to do that. So,
yeah. Well, I look forward to being able to jump on a plane to join you over there. Lots of things on hold.
Totally. Lara, thank you so much for sharing. I really, really appreciate you sharing your story. And I think that it will just help people who are, you know, figuring out their own path to hear how you've done it. So thank you so, so much for sharing.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me on the show. Nice to connect with you after all these years.
Thanks for listening to another episode of the Teaching Yoga Podcast. If you want to stay connected between shows, make sure you join my weekly video newsletter, The Practice, at coragiroux.com/newsletter.
If you don't keep it real, then you go somewhere but here, because you know we're only losing control just for a minute. Oh. If you don't like this music, then don't be listening to it. You know I'm just a dude that you know, or something similar. If you don't keep it real, can you go somewhere but here, because you know we're only losing control just for a minute. Oh, oh, oh. Uh-oh, 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 yeah.